Welcome to another edition of the Health First Show. I'm your host, Dave Fuller, and we're going to be talking about vaccines today with Etta West from Vaccine Choice Canada. And in the second half of the show, we're going to be talking sprouts with the Sprout Man. But before we do that, here's Reg with the health news.
A new study finds consuming a modest amount of salt might not harm older adults, but any more than that can damage health. The study of adults aged 71 to 80 found daily consumption of 23 milligrams of salt, the equivalent of a teaspoon, didn't increase deaths, heart disease, stroke, or heart failure over 10 years. However, researchers say salt intake above 2,300 milligrams, which is higher than heart experts currently recommend, might increase the risk for early death and other ailments. The findings shouldn't be considered a license to use the salt shaker indiscriminately. The researchers did not compare high salt intake with low intake. The report was published online January 19th in JAMA Internal Medicine. Having a drink each day might help lower a middle-aged person's odds for heart failure, a new study reveals. The investigation suggests men in their 40s, 50s, and 60s who drink as much as 7 comparably sized glasses of wine, beer, and/or spirits per week will see their risk of heart failure drop by 20%. For women, the associated drop in risk amounted to roughly 16%, according to the study published online January 20th in the European Heart Journal. While the study found an association between moderate drinking and a low risk of heart failure, it wasn't designed to prove cause and effect, and the researchers say the findings shouldn't be used as an excuse to booze it up. A new study suggests lack of sleep raises teens' risk of alcohol and drug problems. Researchers analyzed data from more than 6,500 American teens that was collected in 3 separate waves, 1994-95, 1996, and 2001-2002. The findings appear in the February online issue of the journal Alcoholism, Clinical and Experimental Research. The study only found an association between lack of sleep and drug and/or alcohol problems in teens, not a cause and effect. Link. And finally, being sedentary may be twice as deadly as being obese, a new study suggests. However, the British researchers add even a little exercise, a brisk 20-minute walk each day, for example, is enough to reduce the risk of an early death by as much as 30%. The risk reduction was seen in normal weight, overweight, and obese people, and the study's lead author says from a public health perspective, it is as important to increase levels of physical activity as it is to reduce the levels of obesity, even more so. The report was published January 14th in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition.
Well, our next guest is an alternative voice in the area of vaccine. She represents the group Vaccine Choice Canada. Etta West, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Dave. Good to talk to you again.
You know, a lot of people are concerned about vaccines or the fact that some percentage of the population is unvaccinated. And both sides of that argument believe that their concerns are valid. What is your research showing in terms of vaccine use in Canada? What percentage of the population is vaccinated? And, you know, who's not vaccinating?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. I don't think there are really any clear statistics about it. We do know that in terms of young children, you know, the majority of young children are compliant. So the majority of parents, probably around 95% of parents, still make that choice to bring their babies in to start the series of shots, which starts at 2 months of age in Canada. There are a few areas of the country where there are some vaccines given at birth, but in most provinces, it starts at 2 months, and then it goes on from there. But in terms of the adult population, I think that that's one of the wild cards. I don't think anybody really has a handle on how many adults are fully up to date with all the vaccines they should have. So, and you know, and I mean, right now, people may be aware that there's this measles outbreak going on in California, and what came out very clearly last year when a similar outbreak was happening in a few areas of Canada was people who have been vaccinated, I mean, vaccination provides a temporary immunity. So a very highly contagious disease like measles, if you're fully vaccinated, you can pretty well accept that you're not going to be immune for life. unlike when measles used to go around the neighborhood every 2 or 3 years, there would be measles would make the rounds, and the kids who hadn't had measles would get it and then would go on to develop lifelong immunity. So we had not only true herd immunity when the natural disease was still circulating, but people also had the lifelong benefit of immunity from the disease once they had contracted it naturally. So that's the big dilemma that the vaccinators face today, is that the vaccines do not provide the kind of long-term immunity that recovery from the illness does.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of these illnesses that are most popular that we're being vaccinated against, measles, mumps, and chickenpox, are they dangerous if we get them?
Are the diseases dangerous?
Yes.
Yeah, yes, of course, that's a key question, because they are being sold as dangerous diseases. And so it's really interesting, you know, are they or are they not? Certainly in poorly nourished populations, in the developing world, for example, where people are immune compromised, they're nutritionally deficient, there's no adequate sanitation. You know, when we have those really, really very, very harsh living conditions, yes, any of these diseases can be dangerous. But in a well-nourished population, well-nourished children, if we're talking about the child population, you know, the children can pick them up and can get through them and then go on to develop the lifelong immunity. And especially if they're treated properly during the illness, which means not interfering with antipyretics, that is fever-reducing medications, which can increase mortality. So if you have a child that has one of these illnesses, and then you start killing the fever with an antipyretic like acetaminophen, you can actually increase the risk of mortality in that person. So the fever serves a really, really important purpose. The fever is there to rally the immune system to its maximum degree of recognizing the pathogen and of responding appropriately. So if you kill the fever, you do that consistently, you're basically not, and you're disabling the immune system from doing the full-blown job that it needs to do to deal with a pathogen and to be able to then eliminate it from the body.
Etta, tell us a little bit about the history of vaccines and you know, why they're, you know, so prominent today in terms of healthcare.
Yeah, well, you know, this is a good question. I've been watching this and following this this information for over 35 years, and so I have a historical perspective. At my age now, I'm in my 70s, and I got involved in this in my early 30s when my youngest child had a severe reaction to a measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine that I didn't want to give her, but I was arm twisted. I was fear mongered into giving her that shot. And it opened the door for me to I stepped through a doorway into another worldview that I didn't know existed. Until that time, I was like most parents. I just believed, you know, vaccines are the way to go. And that's what you do if you're a responsible parent. I had no knowledge of vaccine reactions or injuries, or that, you know, a vaccination can go horribly wrong. And so this led me on a long course of studying the history of diseases and what were the factors that brought about a decline in mortality. Because when we're talking about diseases, that's the important thing that we want to understand. Is this a life-threatening disease? Or if we get through this disease, will it give us the benefit of having long-term immunity? And that's the big question that the majority of people are not clear about, and that then enables them to be more vulnerable to medical propaganda, mainstream medical propaganda, which loves to fearmonger. So the way that vaccines are sold is by this constant, constant fearmongering that goes. And we see it with every measles outbreak that happens, for example. We see it every year in flu season. You know, you got to get your shots because, you know, there's this always this looming threat of how bad the diseases are. And there's no emphasis put on the really foundational things we need to do to take care of our health, which is create a strong immune system through healthy lifestyle, through good nutritional practices. But in the history of diseases, we saw the most, you know, remarkable decline. Where many of the diseases in terms of the mortality rates, there were huge declines. Measles mortality rates declined by 99% before they brought in the vaccines. And these people who run the current orthodox monopoly medicine, they seem to be addicted to this fear-mongering. So they cannot, they seem to be unable to tell the public the truth. And the truth of the matter is that mortality from the majority of the diseases that they vaccinate for now had long declined before the vaccines were introduced and there was mass vaccination programs. So unless the public has that information, they're easily captive to fear-mongering and to propaganda. So it's really important that we understand not the history of diseases, why they declined. The decline happened because of all of the improvements that were made in basic public health. So the public health machine, you know, in days gone by, let's say the early 20th century, it was involved in clean water, sanitation, sewage, improving nutrition, less crowded housing, and those were the factors, that especially the improved nutrition, that led to the decline of mortality and diseases. It was not vaccines. Vaccines had played an absolutely insignificant role. But it's all been spun. This is all spun propaganda to make the public believe that vaccines have saved us, and it is not the case.
And, you know, the measles outbreak that started in Disneyland this year,
yep.
You know, they're blaming that on unvaccinated people. What mm-hmm. percentage of people in these outbreaks are vaccinated?
Well, we haven't seen the statistics yet. I was just, you know, reading some material this morning, and people are calling for, okay, let's have an analysis here. First of all, often measles is diagnosed when it's not measles at all. Recent information out of the UK have found that when they analyzed something like 4,000 cases that were reported as measles, they found that only 2.5% of those cases actually were measles, because there are many diseases that come with a fever and a rash that people automatically assume this is measles. So that was pretty eye-opening and startling to think that official UK statistics in England have shown in recent years that only 2.5% of reported cases actually, when analyzed, are measles, okay? So there's a huge margin of error in terms of, stating it as this is measles when it isn't. So we don't know with the California outbreak how many of those cases are actually measles, how many occurred in fully vaccinated people or partially vaccinated people or unvaccinated people. We don't have that information yet.
What about some of the other outbreaks, the measles outbreaks, that, you know, in Quebec and Kansas
yep.
City?
Yeah,
the
Quebec one that happened in 2011, that's an important one for people to be aware of, because in one high school in Quebec where I think that was the epicenter of the measles outbreak, the 98 high school students that got measles, 51% of them were fully vaccinated. That means with two doses of the MMR vaccine. The MMR vaccine is the triple live virus vaccine, so it contains measles, mumps, and rubella in it. So we have 51% of fully vaccinated people developing measles. So health officials were in a tizzy over that, and they were speculating that, well, perhaps it was because the kids got the vaccines too early, that that perhaps there's a better response rate and that the vaccine works better if they wait a little longer, like, because most children in Canada get the measles, the MMR vaccine, which contains the measles, at age 12 months, and that perhaps they should wait until 15 months because there are maternal circulating antibodies that children get. In the old days, when everybody got measles, certainly in my lifetime, everybody in my lifetime would have had measles, and I was born in 1943. My older children, who were born in the 1960s, both of them had full-blown measles, and they would have gotten lifelong immunity. These people who have had measles pass on to their babies, the mothers who've had measles pass on strong cross-placental immunity to their babies. So their babies are protected well in the first year of life from measles if they're exposed. The mothers who are vaccinated don't give the same degree of protection. It is less. They give some, but it doesn't last as long as the mothers who've had measles naturally.
We're talking with Etta West. She is the representative of Vaccine Choice. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be finding out more about the risks and benefits associated with vaccines.